Have you ever expended, brethren, a large amount of effort and received little or no return as a result? Something that you worked very hard for, focused on, and yet it did not pan out or bear fruit. How'd you feel when that happened? A little empty? Like you'd wasted something in your life? Like something maybe you should have just passed right on by and not been involved in at all? When that happens, doesn't it make you question a little bit the value of what you had just done? Again, you work very, very hard, you're diligent, but there's no real response. When I was growing up in the family, from time to time, my dad would come up with some way that we as a family could make a few dollars and contribute to the expenses as a whole. And he decided this time that we would harvest pine cones. We went out there, four boys, mom and dad, trooping through the woods. Didn't know any more about harvesting pine cones than we did about fishing for whales, I suppose. And we were out there in the forest knocking these pine cones down, climbing trees, pitch all over us. Part of the forest had burnt, so we climbed up where all the char and the ash was and turned black as well. And knocked all these cones out, stuck them in burlap bags, and hauled them to the ranger station for our funds. Ranger cut a few open. The seed count was very poor. Gave us something like $7 for the day. Six people all day, $7. That just about paid our gas. In fact, we might have gone the whole. Turned out to be a waste of our time. Great effort expended, nothing produced. It was a waste of our time. We've all wasted our time at one point or another in our lives. Let's not do that today. Let's not waste today. Most of us, I'm sure, have fasted before, and likely most of us could remember days in which we indeed intended to fast and we did not eat and drink, but in the end, actually, we simply went hungry. The day so much filled with obligations and commitments and relationship needs and things that occupied our mind and our focus and our time that even though we weren't eating and drinking, indeed, we were doing no more than going hungry. Not truly fasting in the sense that God intended. You know, millions of people are going hungry today. They're not keeping the Day of Atonement. And in that sense, it isn't for no productive good. They're not keeping today. They're just not eating. Peter Little mentioned in his opening prayer about being at one, praying that we could be at one with God. Atonement, broken down in the English, means just that, to be at one with God. In the dictionary, it means to be reconciled. To do that, to accomplish that, there has to be a change. Now, God doesn't change. In that sense, we have to change. We have to become less physically focused and more spiritually focused to be at one with God. We have to move to Him. Now, reconciliation obviously implies as well there's forgiveness. But it means that we have to become more like God, not God has to become more like us. And it's very important to understand that distinction that is there. Fasting helps us to do that. Fasting helps us to see ourselves and also God more clearly. It helps us to focus on and be sensitive to the change there that needs to take place. In Isaiah 55, verse number 2 and 3, there's a passage that not directly related to atonement or fasting, but related in the sense that why do something that is of no profit to you? Why waste your time? Verse 2, it says, why do you spend money for what is not bread? And your wages for what does not satisfy? Listen diligently to me, and eat what is good. Let your soul delight itself in abundance. Now, obviously, we're not talking about, let's go get a burger. It's just saying in principle, it says, look, why do you pursue something that is a waste? Why do you do something that is not profitable? Incline your ear, come to me, hear, and your soul shall live, and I will make an everlasting covenant with you, the sure mercies of David. It's important, brethren, that if we're going to not eat and not drink on this day and keep this holy day before God, that it not be a waste of our time. That we do more than simply go hungry and get thirsty, because there is great purpose in this day. Fasting, in that sense, isn't just a physical process. Going hungry is. Fasting is not. It's more than that. There are things in my life that I desired, and I assumed that even though they were difficult for me to accomplish, that if I just did them over and over and over again, that I would accomplish that task. When I was in high school, I wanted to learn how to type. And so I'm in high school class, and the teacher, of course, makes you not look at the, what do they call it? They didn't have keyboards, whatever, the typewriter, whatever we were using. And so you're supposed to look somewhere else and type, and your fingers are supposed to know where to go, and mine didn't. So whenever she turned around, I'd look down, type real quick, and then smile and type real quick, and that's how I made through type, and I got up to 30 words a minute, hunt and peck. Didn't learn to type. When I got to college, I went to college class again in typing, did the same thing, got out 30 words a minute, hunt and peck. I wanted to be a musician, not a great one, just mediocre one. So I bought me a guitar. And I reasoned that if I played that guitar, I'd learn how to chord and change the chords and strum on that guitar, and I could have a lot of fun with it. So I took lessons, and I never learned to change chords with my left hand. I found that if I didn't look with my eyes, I couldn't see where to put my fingers for the next chord. I took lessons 3 times, once formally with an instructor sitting there as he gasped and groaned as I strove to change those chords, and I couldn't do it. So I decided that, well, can't learn to play guitar, I'll play the piano. Now, I'm amazed at special music. I'm honestly amazed. I listen sometimes, and I'm just in awe that somebody can actually do that. It's an incredible thing. I took piano lessons when I was a senior in college. It was supposed to be my easy class when I finished school so that I could kind of breeze through it, and it'd be an easy one. Lowest grade I got that year was piano. I would sit there at the keys, and I remember concentrating so diligently that I would break out in sweat, and it would drip down off of my forehead. I was concentrating so hard, and I never learned to play the piano. The only way I could describe it is my fingers have no memory. My wife says there's other parts of me have none either, but my fingers for sure have no memory. And I thought if I just kept going through the motions, eventually it would work. And I found out that the physical motions simply weren't enough. With fasting, it's the same. Our success is not measured by how often we have avoided food and drink. Our success is not measured by the physical intensity of our hunger. Our success is measured rather by the intensity of our closeness to God, to be at one with God. Do we do it or do we not? Do we attain that or do we miss it completely? Do we waste our time? I know there have been numerous times in my life when I, for convenience sake, moved my fast into a period of time when I needed to accomplish or produce something else, and I wasted my time. Leviticus 23 is the passage where the holy days are quantified, and the Day of Atonement is described there and commanded for our observance. As the Lord spoke to Moses and said, on the 10th day of the 7th month is the Day of Atonement. It's a holy convocation. You assemble. You don't just sit home and relax. You afflict your souls and offer an offering made by fire to the Lord. Now, it doesn't say in this passage not to eat or drink. It says to afflict ourselves, but we see by example that that's the way it was kept. And I'll use some of those scriptures later on through the sermon. But it says we shall do no work on that same day. It's a day of atonement. In fact, it doesn't just say you don't do any regular work. You don't do any work. You don't prepare your meals. At the bottom, it shall be a Sabbath of solemn rest, rest from everything. Rest from all activity. You shall afflict your souls on the 9th day of the month at evening. From even to even, you shall celebrate your Sabbath. And so God gave us, in that sense, a 24-hour period. And in order for us to be able to be at one with Him, He, by regulation, got us to remove all obligations on that day, effectively. And we don't work at our jobs. And we don't work in our homes. And we don't even have to prepare or focus on preparing our meals and all of the work and association that goes with that, so that we would be able to focus on our relationship to Him. If we do not do that, if we're not able to do that, then we simply don't accomplish the purpose of this day. The purpose is not to just see how hungry you can get. I've heard explanation given in the past how 36 hours is more righteous than 24. How what you do is you start fasting the day before so you get all the food out of your stomach so that you're hungry when you start atonement. Somehow that makes it more atoning than some other way. All I'd say, it makes it more of a penance, maybe, or more of a punishment, but I don't know that that necessarily in and of itself will draw us any closer to God. There are people, some of us here, who can't fast, or can only fast for a very few hours, or who probably never in their life have ever so much as finished a 24-hour period of time totally without food and water. They can't do it. They're too weak. The body is too weak, or the needs of the body are too high, and they can't accomplish that purpose. Does that mean they're less spiritual? That's obviously not the point. There's a lesson learned in the course of the not eating and drinking, and it's important to learn that, but it goes beyond that. There's more to it than that. The word afflict in the Hebrew, as it is used in other parts of the Old Testament, refers sometimes to harsh and painful treatment. But it's not penance. In other words, it's a difficult circumstance, but it's not some kind of an atonement for our sins. Christ's sacrifice is the atonement for our sins. What we are doing by fasting is humbling ourselves, learning to be more submissive to God. You see, sin puffs up by analogy, and we're to deflate during this time. We're to go the other direction. We're to bow down a little bit and strive to understand and exhibit a meekness and a humility in our lives. And atonement, the Day of Atonement, is generally one of our best opportunities to do so. Again, because our days are wiped free and clean for us to do that. Drawing close to God, being at one with God, is the primary reason why we fast. Notice James 4. James 4, verse number 8. Says, draw near to God, be at one with God, strive to get close to Him, change to focus more like God is focused, and He will draw near to you. Cleanse your hands, you sinners, purify your hearts, you double-minded. In other words, have a single focus. Don't be distracted and don't be torn. Have a single focus. Lament and mourn and weep. Let your laughter be turned to mourning, your joy to gloom. Humble yourselves in the sight of the Lord, and He will lift you up. Now, that's not the only way we are in obedience to God, but that is a way that relates to this day. We actually deflate ourselves, reduce ourselves in a way that is significant and important to God. We humble ourselves before Him. We shouldn't, brethren, just do that when it's commanded. It ought to be part of our lifestyle. It ought to be part of our approach. There ought to be something that carries over into our life in this way. In Luke chapter 2, we have the example of Anna and how she took something in her life which was tragic and she turned it into a great blessing because she spent her life focusing on her relationship to God. It's an incredible thing. Luke 2, verse 36. It says, there was one Anna, a prophetess, of the tribe of Asher. I always skip over the words I can't pronounce, and that way you don't know that I stumbled. She was of great age, had lived with her husband 7 years from her virginity. Very short marriage she had. Probably married maybe 13, 14 years old. My grandmother, I think, was married at 14. Very early. Says this woman was a widow of 84 years, so she's probably over 100. Lexi Blair in Lubbock, Texas, turned 100 about a month back, one of the members there. It's amazing to talk to someone, know someone at 100 years old that is doing reasonably well. This Anna was older than that. And did not depart from the temple, but served God with fasting and prayers night and day. And coming in that instant, she gave thanks to the Lord and spoke to Him of all those who looked for redemption in Jerusalem. Says that even though she had been widowed and had this great vacuum, as we would describe it or see it sometimes in her life, she was very young, and yet she filled her life with fasting and prayer in a way that she focused on her relationship to God. A great blessing indeed that she there had. She did something that was more than what was commanded. She went above and beyond and lived her life in that way. We are told that if we only do what we are commanded, we are unprofitable servants. What are we commanded? We're commanded to fast on the Day of Atonement. Just think back in your own life. How much did fasting play a part in the last 12 months of your life? How many times did you resort to that means to draw close to God and to try to focus? And I even looked back my own self and I just said, you know, I used to fast more. I used to. And I had to stop and think, am I losing focus too? I hope I'm not, but God says if we only do what He commands us, that we're still not profitable. That's why we have offerings. It goes beyond. It's up to us. It shows what's in our heart. If we only fast on atonement, then we have done the absolute minimum. How close to God do we really want to be? When we draw close to God, we're better able to seek His will. How many times have you asked and prayed and tried to understand what God's will for you in a matter was, what it was that He would have you to do? When we draw close to God, when we're at one with God, we more clearly understand His will. When I was in Pasadena, I worked for Ellis LaRavia. And he hired me, and I'd only met him once or twice and didn't really know him at all, and he hired me as his personal aide. And very shortly, he gave me an assignment. We had a discussion. He said, would you please write that memo for me and then return it to my desk? So I thought, okay. So I went over and I got very creative and said something like, well, how are you? It's sure good to see you or talk to you again. It was great the other day. And I made all this, you know, personal comment, which nobody can do for anybody else. And then I wrote this long memo and I put it on his desk. And a couple of days later, I was in the office and I noticed my memo laying on his desk with red pen marks all over it. Top to bottom, sides, notes, scratched. I couldn't write a memo for him because I didn't know him. I didn't have a clue how he thought or functioned or what he would have said himself. And he had to take it and completely rewrite the memo. Served him no purpose at all. You know how long it took me to write a memo that finally went across his desk and he signed his name on it? About 2 years. As a personal aide, it took me 2 years to write well enough so that he wouldn't have to do anything, just sign his name. And then I could write memos for him. Send notes to his wife. Not that good. You can't just be at one with God at some moment's notice. It's a process. It's something you pursue. It's something we have to work with. Spend time. It's a process that has to take place. Fasting is part of that process. It enables part of that process. When we're trying to seek God's will and understand His mind, we fast and pray and ask for His intervention in our own minds. When the apostles were going to ordain Barnabas and Paul, they fasted and prayed first. And then they set them aside. Michelle and I, the first time we tried to buy a house, it was a scary thing for us. We didn't feel we could necessarily afford it, but maybe we could, and we wanted to buy a house, and it was the very first one. And so we put an offer on this house, and we had a real estate agent, and we engaged her, and we thought about, well, we got to be able to pay third tithe year, so we scheduled that into the mortgage requirements on the payments, and we just laid this thing all out, detail by detail, right through. And before we actually turned that offer in, we stopped and we fasted. And brethren, I believe we ought to fast before God before we make any major decision in this life that's going to impact the course of our life, that it would be good to stop and ask God's will in the matter and His participation. And we stopped and we fasted, and then we turned the offer, and the offer was good for 5 days. We didn't hear anything for 4 days, and then on the fifth day, as I remember now, was the fifth day that the offer was not taken. And the agent then later told us that the owner was generally favorable to our offer and was seriously considering it, but he was kind of waiting because he had some business matters in process, and he had a business failure that finally happened and took place that prevented him from selling the house on the fifth day and stopped the sale. Otherwise, probably would have gone through. Well, we thought we just lost the house and wasn't much you could do about it, and trusted that was God's will, didn't understand why, and went by that house a little later, how you go by and you look to see what had happened, or, oh, that could have been ours, and turns out there was a group of motorcycle Now, not that everyone who rides a motorcycle is. But there were chopped Harleys in the yard, and there was a group of motorcycles, and they lived in that house and shared the house next door to us. And, you know, I can understand that maybe that wouldn't necessarily be a problem, but in Southern California, that isn't always the place that you would find a place that you'd park and raise your kids and be with grandma. Wouldn't necessarily be the kindest, gentlest place on the earth. I believe, looking back, that God blessed us and intervened for us and stopped that process from taking place. It's so important, brethren, that we utilize fasting in a proper way. Fasting also helps us to focus our prayers. Our prayers sometimes wander and maybe miss at times, and it's hard to really be consistent, but fasting helps that. David described a time in the Bible in Psalm 69 when he was in serious trouble. Trouble that I guess would probably be the worst times that we would describe in our own lives. But Psalm 69, notice the way David describes the circumstance here. He says, "Save me, O God, for the waters have come up to my neck." Well, I guess that's about as far as it can go. "I sink in deep mire where there is no standing. I've come into deep waters where the floods overflow me." He says, "I'm weary with my crying. My throat is dry. My eyes fail while I wait for my God." He says, "Those who hate me without a cause are more than the hairs of my head. They are mighty who would destroy, being my enemies wrongfully. Though I have stolen nothing, I must still restore it." I try to picture how David felt. One time I was working at a summer camp, and they had septic tanks. That's what they had. They used septic tanks for some of the facilities there, and one of the septic tank lids had caved in. It was made out of wood, and they asked me to go check on it and see what the problem was and repair it. So I went over there, and I kind of cleaned it up a little bit, and there was a hole there in the middle, and I kind of got down on my hands and knees, and I put one hand on each side, and I was looking through to see what the damage was and what it took to be repaired, and the board with my left hand on it gave way and went through, and it was that right hand holding on like you've never held on in your life what kept me from going in head first. And I just barely hung on. David here says, you know, the waters have come up to my neck. I'm sinking in deep mire where you can't even stand. And it's kind of humorous to think about the fact that I almost went in head first, but David felt like that, and he's describing that, and he's describing then what his response to that, what he had to do to resolve his issue there. In verse 10, he says, "When I wept and chastened my soul with fasting, that became my reproach. I also made sackcloth my garment." He humbled himself. He was in a situation which there was no way out, and there was no honor and glory in it, and so he had no choice. He simply humbled himself. He says, "I became a byword to them. Those who sit in the gate speak against me. I am the song of the drunkards." He says, "But as for me, my prayer is to you, O Lord, in the acceptable time, O God, in the multitude of your mercy. Hear me in the truth of your salvation. Deliver me out of the mire." So he's asking that God would indeed deliver him. He says, "Don't let me sink. Let me be delivered from those who hate me. Out of the deep waters, let not the flood water overflow me or the deep swallow me up." Verse 10, he says, "When I wept and chastened my soul with fasting," he says, "and I turned my focus to you." Fasting was a means that David used to help him to reduce himself, to step back, to move aside. He also used that very same tool when he prayed for others, when he prayed for others' problems, to humble himself in that respect as well. Psalm 35, he mentioned here how he fasted for others and the impact that that had. Talked about those who were his friends who turned against him. It says, "Fierce witnesses rise up. They ask me things that I don't know. They reward me evil for good to the sorrow of my soul. But as for me, when they were sick," he says, "my clothing was sackcloth. I humbled myself with fasting. And my prayer would return to my own heart. I paced about as though he were my friend or brother. I bowed down heavily as one who mourns for his mother." He simply describes here a time when those who he was concerned about suffered and were in pain, and he humbled himself and he sought God's intervention on their behalf. Through fasting, we can develop compassion and sensitivity. It's more than a physical process. It's more than not eating and drinking. It's a process whereby we submit ourselves to God, and he involves himself with us, and he works with us, and he responds to us. So it's not like we fast in order just to get God's attention. I believe we fast to get our own attention. I remember one time facing a particular battle mentally and emotionally, and I was driving in the car, and I kept fighting my thoughts and struggling and trying to work through, and you say, "Oh, stop, I won't think about that," and you'd pass that off and you'd keep driving on. And finally I just said, "This is not working. I am going to fast, and I'm going to start this minute." And it was the most incredible thing. The minute I made that choice and decision, that trial just passed. Now, I didn't have time to get into the fast. I didn't have time to work in terms of attitude and approach. I just simply made the decision, and at that moment, the mental thought process that I battled with just stopped. It's something that God grants us to use to draw close to him. It's not just a physical process. I mean, my consumption didn't change. I was driving the car. It was simply the decision to begin one. And I carried through and I finished and felt like I had accomplished something and gone where God would have had me to go. Attitude and approach is important, brethren. We are here to give God honor and to increase our ability to be of his service. Isaiah 58 is a passage that talks about the attitude of fasting and maybe some of the mistakes that are made by those who do in the same time. Isaiah 58, verse number 3. Comparing fasting that is not pleasing to God to fasting that is, but it says, "Why have we fasted, they say, and you have not seen? Why have we afflicted our souls and you didn't take notice?" The cry going out, so to speak, that, look, I did my part, now God, get to work and do what I have requested of you. God says, well, look, in the day of your fast, you find pleasure. You exploit all your labors. Indeed, you fast for strife and debate and to strike with a fist of wickedness. You will not fast as you do this day to make your voice heard on high. We do not make any demands of God, brethren. We simply humble and submit ourselves to him, draw close to him. God simply shows that he is responsive to that. Verse 5, is it a fast that I have chosen? And he describes his intention. A day for a man to afflict his soul. Is it to bow down his head like a bulrush and to spread out sackcloth and ashes? Would you call this a fast? Fasting is not intended just to make us miserable. It's not a day where we simply walk around meek, bent over, with cotton mouth, feeling miserable and feeling like somehow that satisfies God. What God is asking, indeed, that we would produce something out of our fast, that there would be an attitude and approach, and there would be something, indeed, that was accomplished. We can be just as miserable as we want on any day. When we were kids, our aunt and uncle gave us some wool tweed pants, and it took me years to forgive them. Three boys at that time, and every one of us had a pair of these wool tweed pants, and we'd wear them to church, and they would itch you to death. So when someone talks about sackcloth, putting sackcloth on, that's something that really gets your attention and focus. And we'd wear these wool tweed pants to church, and it got to where we would wear long underwear under them, even in the summer, to try to reduce this itching and this discomfort. God isn't just trying to make us uncomfortable. He wants us to focus on the fact that we're not doing this here. We need to be doing this here. We need to change the things that we focus on. He says, is this not the fast that I have chosen? To loose the bonds of wickedness, to undo the heavy burdens, to let the oppressed go free, and that you break every yoke. Fasting, in part, is to break loose from the bondage of sin. What is it in our lives that we can't break free of? What is it in our lives that constrains us and remains with us and follows us everywhere we go. God says fasting in part is to release you from bondage, to let the oppressed go free, to relieve the burdens, to break the yokes. But it's not just the yokes that are on our back, as our neck, that need to be broken. Sometimes it's those around us who need to be set free as well. It says, is it not to share your bread with the hungry, that you bring into your house the poor who are cast out? And when you see the naked, that you cover him and not hide yourself from your own flesh. I heard it explained one time that we were saving so many dollars today by not eating, therefore we should donate that to the poor. That's fine if that's what you want to do. I'm not convinced that's the point. I think the point is when we see our own need and our own weakness, and then we can look at someone else a little differently. And we can look at someone else a little more compassionately. And maybe we'll be a little more focused on seeing what their need is as well and where we can meet it, indeed, participate in the way that we should. That seemed to come through so loud and clear from Mr. Hume's letter on the family that was working there in India. It seemed to me that they were focused on meeting people's needs where they could and in contributing to them in that way. Then your light shall break forth like the morning. Your healing shall bring forth speedily, and your righteousness shall go before you, and the glory of the Lord shall be your rear guard. Then you will call, and the Lord will answer. You shall cry, and he will say, here I am. God just says, you know, when your attitude is a little purer, and when your heart is a little cleaner, and when your approach is such, he says, I am going to respond to you. I want you to humble yourself. I want you to be meek in your approach and sensitive to those around you. And God says, I honor that and I appreciate that and I will be responsive to that. There are benefits in fasting that are physical, I'm sure, but the benefits fundamentally are spiritual. For whatever reason, when I fast, I don't particularly have a problem with it. And if discomfort was the criteria for success, then I just simply would have to go on for a considerable amount of time because in one day I don't even get thirsty. I don't know why, but I just don't. I've just never had a problem speaking on atonement because I've never had that cotton mouth that comes so naturally without the liquid. My body just simply tolerates it well. So if the level of discomfort was what was necessary, then I think I flunked every fast. But what I think about constantly on atonement is the fact that I am not eating, that I cannot have my banana bread, that I'm going on and that this time is free and that my mind is free and that I do change focus. And it's a constant reminder because it is so different from a normal day. The benefits of fasting are intended to be ultimately spiritual. We come to trust God, to look to Him more carefully, to rely on Him more fully. And it's an important process that must take place. I mentioned on trumpets that when Michelle was in labor with Megan, what a difficult circumstance for us it was. Michelle was in hard labor for 20 hours. I could finally see how women out on the plains on those wagon trains would die in childbirth or someplace where they were alone, where a baby simply wasn't delivered and they continued on in labor until they were exhausted and finally died. I finally saw how that could happen. And after 20 hours, Michelle was weakening, and I could just see there was a change in her countenance and her ability to struggle on and the pain of this hard labor. And only a woman would really know and understand what kind of pain that is. But the doctor who was delivering the child was a friend of ours, and we had picked him so that we would have a natural delivery, and we all but threatened him that if this was anything but natural, that wasn't according to our will. And so he's going to do anything besides cut her open and take that baby, and I finally had to say, do it! In fact, I finally had to argue with him and say, now I want a C-section, now take this baby. Because he didn't know if I was serious or not, because we'd worked him the other way for so long. So I had to demand that he do that. Before Michelle went in for that operation and she's laying in this labor, she's crying out, God, where are you? Why have you left me this way? Where are you? We're praying for God to intervene. Bring this baby. Stop the labor. You know, finish the process. Do something. And it never happened. And so finally, when they took her in and did the C-section and brought the baby out, they looked inside there as they opened that uterus up, and the placenta had not released from the wall of the uterus, and it's what they call a placenta accretia or a partial. And apparently what happens, me not being a doctor, but apparently what happens if the baby was to have been delivered at that point, the placenta would tear off of the wall and she would begin to hemorrhage. Now if you're on the table and that happens and you hemorrhage on the inside, you can't exactly apply direct pressure. And now you're in a life-threatening situation where they have to get in there and stop the bleeding right now. Or you could die very quickly. And so we're crying out, God, where are you? And God effectively was saying, right here, Johnny, on the spot, I'm taking care of you. If you just understood what I'm doing, or when you do understand, then you'll know. You know, we believe that he actually prevented the birth of Megan so that Michelle's health would be protected in the process. While he's intervening, helping us, we're saying, where are you? What's going on? It's important, brethren, that we draw close to God, close enough to trust him, close enough to put our lives into his hands, trust close enough to believe that all things do indeed work together for good, and when something happens in our lives and we are submissive to him, that it is something God will work out, even though you might not see it at the time, even though you might not feel it at the moment. At one moment. To be at one with God, to be closer to his will, to understand his purposes, and to trust him. It's part of what fasting is all about. It's part of what this day is all about. And again, if all we do is fail to eat or drink, we miss the point. We simply don't accomplish our purpose. Repentance is fundamental to meekness and humility, to deflating, to being at one with God. There's examples in the Bible of people who were spared, who weren't even converted, weren't even nice people. But because before God, when confronted by God, they showed humility and backed off and reduced themselves, God actually turned and spared them, even though they were very horrible people. It's an incredible thing to understand that God is so responsive to that attitude and approach. 1 Kings 21. Verse number 17 is the account here where Elijah is going to Ahab to tell him that he's dead. It's over. It says, the word of the Lord came to Elijah and said, arise, go down to meet Ahab, the king of Israel, who lives in Samaria. There he is in the vineyard of Naboth, where he has gone down to take possession of it. Of course, he'd killed the man in order to take possession of the vineyard after threatening him. You shall speak to him, saying, thus says the Lord, have you murdered and also taken possession? And you shall speak to him, said, thus says the Lord, in the place where dogs lick the blood of Naboth, dogs shall lick your blood, even yours. Now, apparently that got his attention. But notice in verse 25 what kind of man that he was. There was no one like Ahab who sold himself to do wickedness in the sight of the Lord. He just absolutely was in pursuit of evil because Jezebel, his wife, stirred him up. And he behaved abominably in following idols, according to all that the Amorites had done, whom the Lord had cast out before the children of Israel. So it was when Ahab heard these words that he tore his clothes and put sackcloth on his body, and he fasted and lay in sackcloth, and he went about in mourning. Someone who is a horrible person sold himself to sin against God. When God confronted him, stopped and said, oops, I better back off. This isn't going to work. God has condemned me. And he tore his clothes, put on sackcloth, went about in mourning. And the word of the Lord came to Elijah, saying, see how Ahab has humbled himself before me? Because he has humbled himself before me, I will not bring the calamity in his days. But in the days of his son, I'll bring the calamity on his house. And his son could have walked around in humility as well. His son could have backed off and reduced himself as well. He wasn't even converted. In fact, he was openly evil. And because he humbled himself before God at that moment, God actually spared him the result of what God said he really deserved. You think God is responsive to true humility or a meekness or a backing down and a humbling of ourselves? Seems to be in the Bible as I see it. Wouldn't God's people, God's own people, even be spared even more so if they humbled themselves, if we humbled ourselves? Joel 2 and verse number 15. Blow the trumpet in Zion, consecrate a fast. Call my people to fast. Call a sacred assembly. Gather the people, sanctify the congregation, assemble the elders, gather the children, the nursing babes, let the bridegroom go out from his chamber. It says, let those people that are celebrating and feasting stop for now. We're calling a fast. Let's all be backing down. Let's all be reducing, and let's go ahead and submit ourselves now to God. Let's cut out the good times for a moment and focus on the immediate need at hand. And the bride from her dressing room. Let the priests who minister to the Lord weep between the porch and the altar. Let them say, spare your people, O Lord, and do not give your heritage to reproach, that the nation should rule over them. Why should they say among the peoples, where is their God? It says, then the Lord will be zealous for his land and pity his people. It says, then God will respond to his people. It's incredible, brethren, to think about it, that God would have to really command us to fast, but he does. And we do so in response to that. But what God wants is not that we would simply go through the physical process, not eat and drink. He wants us to humble ourselves before him so that he can bless us and raise us back up. Let God raise us up. Let's not raise ourselves up in that sense. Brother, we need to really be pursuing our relationship with God in a zealous and fruitful manner. We need to do it as diligently as we would do other things in our life that we surely desired. We need to pursue God just as zealously as that, as the way we would pursue some great accomplishment. When we were fly fishing, my cousin Len and I, and I began to count how often I would cast and how long that fly would float. And we were aiming for a little spot about 6 inches wide when we were fishing. And you had to hit that with the fly, and then the fly had to float right down there against the rock, and you couldn't have it move or jiggle in any way that was unnatural, or the fish wouldn't take it. And a long float was about 15 seconds. That was a long float. And most of the times that we would cast would last about half that. And sometimes you'd have to cast two or three times to hit the spot that you really wanted. I figured out that was about 600 casts an hour, about 5,000 casts a day to catch a little slimy fish. And if you didn't concentrate, which I was wont to not do, but you'd sit there and you'd lay that fly out there and you'd make the right cast and it'd make the right float, but because you'd just done that 1,000 times, tend to lose focus a little bit. And I'd be looking around, and the fish would hit my fly. And you have to set it at the exact moment that fish hits the fly, or he just touches it, spits it out, and he's gone. They don't swallow it. They're real finicky fish. And so you had to be actually there focused after 1,000 casts. At that moment, the fish hit, then you bring him out. And I thought, you know, this is really something you have to work hard at. This is diligent. God says, put me first and work so hard now to draw close to me. And so I kind of was looking through the Bible to see, well, who in the Bible showed that kind of diligence and that kind of focus? And I thought about Daniel, the example of Daniel, and why God was able to use him in such an incredible way. But notice Daniel 9. In the first year of the reign of Darius here, verse number 2 of Daniel 9, says, I, Daniel, understood by books the number of the years specified by the word of the Lord, given to Jeremiah the prophet, that he would accomplish 70 years in the desolations of Jerusalem. And Daniel says, "And I set my face toward the Lord God to make requests by prayer and supplications with fasting and sackcloth and ashes." That seems pretty extreme. To sit there in ashes or to reduce himself in such a way and to put on something that was uncomfortable and to stop eating and drinking and to pursue a relationship with God, to focus the mind on God. And it goes on to show in verse number 20, he says, "Now while I was speaking and praying, confessing my sin, the sin of my people Israel," I mean, this is quite a focus, "and presenting my supplication before the Lord my God for the holy mountain of my God, yes, while I was speaking in prayer, the man Gabriel, whom I had seen in the vision at the beginning, being caused to fly swiftly, reached me about the time of the evening sacrifice. And he informed me and talked with me and said, 'O Daniel, I have now come forth to give you skill to understand.' He says, 'At the beginning of your supplications, the command went out, and I've come to tell you, for you are greatly loved.'" Daniel focused intently on God, and the angel tells him, "You are greatly loved. I love you deeply. I have a relationship with you. You are at one with me. We are of one mind together." And he says, "Therefore, consider the matter and understand the vision." And God used him in a great way. Now, I'm not saying that if you get close to God, he'll give you a vision. That's not my point. But that God loved him and felt close to him. And Daniel was very zealous to maintain that relationship and contact. And he was able to set aside those things that were necessary in order to do so. Every person that I counsel for baptizing, I ask them to do one thing before I baptize them. Not because the Church of God requires it, not because it's in the Bible, but I ask them to do one thing for a specific purpose, and I'll explain that to you. For when I counsel someone for baptism, after all the counseling is over, after the person to me shows that they are indeed committed and I am ready to baptize them and they're wanting to go through with it, I say, "Now please, I ask you for your own good to do one thing now before I baptize you, and then let's have the baptism itself." And I say, "I would like you to set aside a day where you have no duties or obligations, where you're not having to worry about taking care of the family or the needs, or where you don't have to worry about your job, or where you're not in school, or something that's going to occupy your mind. And I'd like you to take a day and fast and focus on repentance before God." And I said, "In the midst of that day, I would like you to take a 3-hour block of time. And between studying and meditating and praying, I want you to fill the entire 3-hour block with your concentrated focus on repentance." And I said, "And the reason I'm asking you to do this is because in your life, there are going to be times when you do not feel close to God, or you feel that God is not answering your prayers, or you do not feel like somehow you are at one with God and you're going through a trial, and I want you to taste what it is like to have a focus and a relationship to God that is unique." And I have never talked to the person yet who did what I asked and in the midst of their fast, which is seeking God, took and actually studied for an hour and meditated on that for an hour and prayed for an hour in a block of time that did not make contact with God. Solid contact with God. And I want to give an individual that experience so that when he goes on in life and he gets into trouble and has trial, he knows how to reach God and plug back in. Daniel appears to be the type of individual that simply did that as a matter of course. It was part of the life that he led. Daniel 10. In the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia, a message was revealed to Daniel, whose name was called Belshazzar. The message was true. The appointed time was long. And he understood the message and had understanding of the vision. In those days, I, Daniel, was mourning 3 full weeks. 3 weeks! Mourning? Well, it says he didn't eat pleasant food. No meat or wine came to his mouth, nor did I anoint myself at all till 3 whole weeks were fulfilled. Daniel actually reduced himself in that sense, humbled himself, and began to seek God in a relationship in a very specific and personal way, asking God to intervene. Now, we're not talking here about penance. Again, penance is to pay for a sin. It's a debt. That's not the point. The point is to indeed seek out humility and to design and desire humility and to submit ourselves before God. And it says, then suddenly, verse 10, a hand touched me, which made me tremble on my knees and on the palms of my hands. And he said to me, O Daniel, man, greatly beloved, beloved by God, understand the words that I speak to you and stand upright, for I have now been sent to you. We live in a society that is complete opposite of that. A society that says, no, you deserve pleasure, you deserve honor, you deserve respect. Don't let anybody disrespect you or give you dishonor. Don't forego opportunity when it's there. And God says, no, sometimes I would like you to just sit back and let it all go. Turn loose of it all and let go and focus on me. And humble yourself and reduce yourself in your effort to reach me. And Daniel had a habit, apparently, a custom of doing so. And God comes back each time and says, Daniel, I love you. I love you very much. I feel very close to you. I think it's an incredible thing. All the purposes and lessons of fasting converge on that one basic point. It's to draw close to God and to stay close to God. It's more than a physical process. It's a spiritual process that God intervenes in. That's why we're fasting today. The less that we are able to look to this flesh and to our own wants and desires, and the more we're able to look to God and to His attitude and purpose, the better we can understand what reconciliation really is, and the better we will be able to experience what it truly means to be at one with God.